this afternoon, I went up, and I've been living with this poem for so long, the pieces are getting way out there. And so when I get in a bind like that, I just close everything, close all my notebooks and everything, and start again. And I wrote down some things that I would like to start the session with. And the first is to talk a little about, very little, about the kind of teaching that I do. And I think, I'm not sure, but I think the word for that is parabolic. And what I mean, anyway, is that I pray to see eternity in a grain of sand, as Blake said, and by paying close attention to particular works and characters to unlock some of the general mystery, wonder, and commonality of all life, to enrich theology with poetry and poetry with theology, art with history and history with art. To enrich is the point, to help us see ourselves as others see us, as Bobby Burns said, and to see the world as others have seen it. That's a prayer. That's really a prayer. And it is a prayer that people do ask, what do I have to do with this poem? And then they find out. It's not completely true, what I'm going to say now, but it's true enough. Everything is in anything. Everything is in anything. I think Mary referred to that yesterday when she talked of our images of God as being, this also is thou, neither is this thou. Our image of God. We look at our image of God and we say, this also is thou, neither is this thou. The session will get its second start now, with a rerun from one quote that Mary gave yesterday, and I don't know who said it. I couldn't read the margin. The name was in the margin. It didn't look like Sayers. It didn't look like Williams. But it really struck me as I was reading her notes. And it is this: without this clarification of reason, fact and meaning alike are abandoned, and thought disintegrates into a maundering among slipshod impressions. Soaring flights of fancy do not by themselves constitute imagery. Honesty and sincerity are no more adequate substitutes for intellect in poetry, theology, and worship than in mathematics. An honest mistake remains a mistake, and no degree of sincere goodwill by itself can redeem imprecision. Ignorance, which is the absence of accuracy, wreaks as much havoc as intellectual error resulting from inaccuracy. And where either prevails, imagination and reason perish together. Now, though this statement is relevant to Prufrock's predicament, it is relevant to Prufrock's problem in the poem. But right now I'd like to press its relevance for the reading of poetry in general, and this poem in particular. Satan likes difficult poems. Satan likes difficult poems. And I've met him while reading many. He is there with a familiar temptation. Quote, certainly the writer didn't mean anything particular by creating this garden. You might think that because he took the trouble to write it, selecting these few words and putting them in particular order, that the poem's existence implies obedience to the meaning of the whole poem. But this is nonsense. That's difficult to understand. Certainly he didn't mean what he said. You are free to do whatever you want, make anything you want of this poem. You are a god, equal to the poet. Don't let him tell you what to think. Be free. Whatever you feel about that apple over there is more important than what the poet meant by it. Eat up. Seize power. Enjoy what you like and leave the rest. After all, the poet should be grateful that you consented to come to the banquet he has prepared for you. Who is he to complain if you don't eat? Now this parable, or this parallel, that's a nice Freudian slip, I think, parable. But this parallel could go on forever, really. You could work with that for quite a while. But the point is, don't fall for the temptation and allow yourselves to disintegrate the poem with your maundering, slipshod impressions. A poet doesn't write a poem for you to take off on a flight of fancy. He wants you to do some precise imagining with him. It's a bit like a dance. Each poem is a different dance that is very exciting and meaningful to dance. Pay attention to the steps and moves, the rhythm and gestures, and you too can dance a beautiful poem that the poet would teach you. The poem is a very particular dance. Don't insist on doing your same old polka or liberated free-form boogie. Don't be shy and sit with the tough guy boys on one side of the gym wall throwing spitballs at sissies, or be on the other side with gossiping girls chatting about that good-looking Willie Shakespeare who they're afraid to dance with. Paying attention to poems and stumbling through the first steps pays off in grace. And I can say this because I'm a chicken when it comes to dancing. But the few dances that I have learned in the past have paid off in tremendous self-expression, far more than my doing my free-form rain dance. Now, paying attention to poems and stumbling through the first steps pays off in grace. You can't believe, and I really can't tell you, the graceful dance that I do with Eliot, with this poem, in my own room, after probably 100 hours at least of practicing. Don't allow your imagination to wither into fancy or your reason to wither into reverie. And those in lifestyle know those terms from various kinds of thinking. And I promised at the beginning of this that two quotations, and the other quotation concerns literary allusions in poetry. For example, the Dante quote at the beginning of this poem, Love Song at the Alpha Prufrock. Now, some may question this as showing off. I did. I questioned it as showing off. Though poets sometimes are perverse and proud of their learning, Brooks and Warren, in their book Understanding Poetry, say this: though poets sometimes are perverse and proud of their learning, can we, on the other hand, take our own ignorance at any given moment to be the norm of poetry? That's beautiful. And it isn't just about poetry. I mean, it applies in art. You know, if you're teaching, well, you run into this, Rich. You know, just can we, on the other hand, take our own ignorance at any given moment to be the norm of poetry? If we are not willing to make that rather conceited assumption, then it is our responsibility to try and remedy our ignorance. The critics and scholars are there to help us. End of quote. I might add, all people who know that though they are free to open or not to open a book, once they open it, they have a covenantal relationship with it. Though people are free to express their freedom by opening a book or not opening a book, they're free not to start reading or to start reading. Once they start reading, they have a covenantal relationship with it. Now, people who believe this way are also great helpers, as well as critics and scholars. Though we can never get entirely out of our skins, we can more or less. And to read, we have to try to see through others' eyes, get into other people's skins. Because if we don't see with others' eyes, we have no depth perception of the human predicament or the human celebration. And that's the end of today's trying to pull some things together this afternoon. Now, did you come down with presents? Jane Springham.
She says she wrote that.
Okay. Well, we can... Got one other thing. Archibald MacLeish said that poetry is a trap for meditation. Poetry is a trap for meditation. And I feel I'm spending this time talking about reading poems in general because when I encountered Prufrock when I was a freshman in college, it shivered my timbers. I didn't know what was going on. And I tried to find out, and I started to find out, and it was one of the most tremendous poems I'd ever encountered. At that time, it was definitely the most meaningful. But I know those temptations, ofta. I called him many names before I started to like Eliot. But poetry is a trap for meditation. And I'm reminded of a line from a Rilke poem that the poem is a song in which a man is strangely caught. Poem can be like a song in which a man is strangely caught. But listen to the verbs, this catching, trapping, you know. You are held, and to be held with it, close. Meditation comes from the word to measure. And in reading this poem, measure the man Prufrock until you've measured yourself. Not all of you, but some of you. Measure his world as seen in the images he gives us, and think, as the dictionary tells us, deep and continuous. I think right now for your for all of us and for what we're going to do when these other things are off the printing press, I think I'll just read the poem in one piece. When we start talking about it, we'll be reading it in its pieces. We will be murdering it in order for it to be resurrected in one piece later. But right now, to read the whole thing, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights and one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow in a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the rooms, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes, the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once about the house and fell asleep. And indeed there will be time for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you, and time for me, and time yet for 100 indecisions, and for 100 visions and revisions before the taking of toast and tea. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. And indeed there will be time to wonder, do I dare and do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair with a bald spot in the middle of my hair. They will say, how his hair is growing thin. My morning coat, my collar mounted firmly to the chin, my necktie rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. They will say, but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. where I have known them all already, known them all. I've known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. I know the voices dying with a dying fall beneath the music from a farther room. So how should I presume? And I have known the eyes already, known them all, the eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase, and when I am formulated, sprawling on a pin, when I am pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways? And how should I presume? And I have known the arms already, known them all, arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight downed with light brown hair. Is it perfume from a dress that makes me so digress? Arms that lie along a table or wrap about a shawl? And should I then presume? And how should I begin? Shall I say I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows? I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. And the afternoon, the evening sleeps so peacefully, smoothed by long fingers, asleep, tired, or it malingers, stretched on the floor here beside you and me. Should I, after teas and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis? Though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I have seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter, I am no prophet, and that's no great matter. I've seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I've seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker. And in short, I was afraid. And would it have been worthwhile after all, after the cups, the marmalade, the tea, among the porcelain, some talk of you and me, would it have been worthwhile to have bitten off the matter with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it to some overwhelming question, to say, I am Lazarus, come back from the dead, come back to tell you all, I shall tell you all. If one settling a pillow by your head should say, that is not what I meant at all, that is not it at all. And would it have been worthwhile after all? Would it have been worthwhile? After the sunsets and the dooryards and the sprinkled streets, after the novels, after the teacups, after the skirts that trail along the floor, and this and so much more, it is impossible to say just what I mean. But as if a magic lantern threw the nerves in patterns on a screen, would it have been worthwhile if one settling a pillow or throwing off a shawl and turning toward the window should say, that is not it at all. That is not what I meant at all. No, I am not Prince Hamlet or was meant to be. I am an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two, advise the prince, no doubt an easy tool, deferential, glad to be of use, politic, cautious and meticulous, full of high sentence, but a bit obtuse, at times indeed almost ridiculous, at times almost the fool. I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. I have seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves blown black when the wind blows the waters white and black. We have lingered in the chambers of the sea, by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown, till human voices wake us and we drown. Now this is a love song, and of the kinds of love that you know of or I've mentioned, you've got affection, you've got friendship, you've got eros, and you've got charity, agape. This is a love song. Is he affectionate? Is there a friend here? Is there the eros kind of love that's being talked of? Is there charity here? And I'll leave that question. Another question is, what kind of a man signs his name J. Alfred Prufrock? What kind of a man finds a kind of individuality in the spelling of his name? Or assert himself with a simple pin in his tie? Another question that's kind of fun, just to play with, whether you want to make something of it or not, but Prue is the shortened form of Prudent. There are girls named Prudent, and they're called Prue. And frock is a robe that the 19th century monks wore that is kind of like a long dress coat that covers even the knees. It's way low. Covers you. You want to make something of that. The poem is called A Love Song. A love song is usually a lyric, a very subjective poem, showing and professing a strong love emotion toward someone. And this poem is a dramatic monologue. This is a monologue. Who does Prufrock love in this poem? Now, one thing we can say, some more questions. What's the tone of the poem? The tone is normally the author's attitude toward his materials, the author's attitude toward, say, Prufrock and the words and the images in the poem. But the author's attitude toward that. And then what's the tone? That would be the voice, the tone of voice of the poet. And then what's the tone of voice of Prufrock? What's his tone? What's his attitude toward what he sees as the materials of his universe?
What is that again, John? You're trying to distinguish between Eliot and Prufrock?
Yeah, there is a difference. I mean, the writer of a poem, and this is the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, written by T.S. Eliot. What is Eliot's tone of voice when he writes? And then what's Prufrock's tone? What's his attitude toward what he sees? And what's Eliot's attitude toward Prufrock seeing? Now, sometimes in a poem, the tone of the author and the tone of the persona will be the same. Sometimes, but not always. Prufrock didn't write this poem. Prufrock says this poem. Eliot wrote it.
So Prufrock's the one that speaks the monologue.
Prufrock's talking.
Okay.
Prufrock's saying this. But Eliot wrote it.
Is it about
Well, we can find out something about Eliot because he wrote it, and we can find out what he would have us know about Prufrock too, and we can see Prufrock's attitude toward the world as he sees it, and that may or may not be the same as Eliot sees it.
Maybe it won't be the same as his attitude, but he's trying to say that specific thing.
Who?
Eliot is trying to say what he's trying to say in this way, by having Prufrock say it. By having Prufrock, not that...
Okay.
Eliot is trying to say something.
Yeah.
And so in order to say something, he presents Prufrock in this way.
Mm-hmm.
But agree that they won't be necessarily the same.
Yeah.
Why would Eliot have Prufrock say something he doesn't want to say?
Well, he wants it said. Yeah, Elise?
I'm thinking this is exactly, I don't know if it'll help, but just imagine a real simple level. If you tell a story, you repeat a dialogue that you overhear, so you hear two small children talking to each other, and you repeat it to somebody, you're telling it, their words, it says something about you, say it's humorous. That's all humorous to an adult. It's not even the children aren't being funny. But you can use exactly the same set of words, but the fact that you are repeating them would give it a completely different tone from what those children speaking to each other have. Mm-hmm. And that isn't an artistic representation, but it's something that we all do. It's that hard once you get into a context that you see how you can be involved in that. You use the words and say repeat exactly, but they're not your words, and that's that you repeat them for you as well, and for something about you too.
Mm-hmm. It does. The fact that you tell the story means it's meaningful to you. But it is the idea that, one way of poetry is overheard speech. You know, poetry is overheard speech. And that never really happened. But in this poem, look at it maybe this way. Who wrote the title? The love song J. Alfred Prufrock. Prufrock or Eliot? Eliot did. And who said? Says it? Prufrock does. And will what Eliot is saying with the poem be the same as what Prufrock says? Or are they going to be different? Now, in this poem, you get a picture. Say, how old is Prufrock in this poem?
Middle-aged.
And do you see? I mean, can you conceive? Does it look like a pretty good picture of a middle-aged problem? I mean, is it convincing? Can you imagine that this is something that is said by someone who's middle-aged? Okay, Nancy, how old are you? Okay, then let's see, Audrey?
20.
Let's see, Marianne?
20.
You're 20. Anyone 22? You're 22. Eliot was 22 years old when he wrote this. He's 22 years old when he wrote this poem. But he's they came good, very good. Can you bring them up? Yeah, and you can start them going around the ring. He was 22 years old. I thought he was 29, but this poem was so crazy when it was written, people just couldn't believe it, and it took him 7 years before they'd publish it, before he could get somebody to publish it. And he had Ezra Pound trying to talk to the editor of Poetry Magazine to talk her into publishing it. I mean, Ezra Pound at that time was a name. And it took 7 years before they had published it. He was 22 years old when he wrote this poem. But, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's something that anybody who would be reading this would already recognize.
Mm-hmm. I think my first contact, I was 18 when I first read it, and I said, that's my story, you know. It's not my story. That's part of my story, but it's not my story. And now, at that time in my self-consciousness and in my own do I dare, I could empathize a great deal with Prufrock. My concrete situation and feeling seemed very similar to his in many ways, not in all ways at all, but in some ways it did. At least for the time I was reading the poem. I could see wherever I could have said all those things while I was reading the poem. I also saw that the poem that is being handed out to his coy mistress was my story too. So it isn't, and then it's a real contrast, you know, there. I mean, a person just isn't one, yes, I am Prufrock. No, I'm a lot of people. But I'll go back to that question, and then before we read these poems that are being handed out, what's the tone of the poem, the attitude? What's Prufrock's attitude toward his predicament, and what's Eliot's attitude toward Prufrock's predicament? What is it Prufrock's attitude toward himself, and what's Eliot's attitude toward Prufrock? Now, irony. There's a question on the sheet on irony, but I don't want to dwell. We'll get back to that later, but I want to just say a few things very quickly about that now. What is irony? There are two kinds, basically. The ironical statement indicated a meaning contrary to the one it professes to give. In other words, you say, if it's pouring down rain in the middle of November, cold rain, you say, ah, there's nothing like a warm spring shower. That's an irony of statement, that you're meaning something contrary to what you state. Then there's the irony of event or situation, in which there's a contrast between expectation and fulfillment, or what's deserved and what's gotten, or desert and reward, which is like the one from the Bible, the righteous perish and the wicked prosper. That's an ironic, that's an irony of event or situation, that the righteous perish and the wicked prosper. You would think it would be the righteous prosper and the wicked perish, you see? That would be the normal expectation. But the ironic statement would say it the other way. The irony shows an awareness of the limits of response. Now, the irony shows an awareness of the limits of response, that you can't say just anything, is implied in that statement. Irony is a refusal to make exaggerations, You don't want to exaggerate. I think irony is something that we want to... When I wanted to be cool, I was ironic. I did not want to make an exaggerated response to anything. I was on top of things. I mean, nobody could tell me any book that I wouldn't, you know, try to make them think I knew up and down. You see? I was trying to be cool. I didn't want to respond... to certain movies, like, fantastic movie. No, I'm supposed to say, you know, that's merely a something, you know, blah, blah, blah. I feared exaggerated response, because you can make an ass out of yourself when you make more of a certain kind of response than other people would expect. And exaggerated response, that takes on some more significance when you realize exaggerated response is another name for sentimentality. Sentimentality is exaggerated response. That you're responding to a particular moment without any understanding of a greater... Well, how would you say it? Well, like you write a Rod McEwen lonely poem, you know, and he's getting lonely all over the page and the tears are sogging up the thing and everything. And you want to say, hey, come on now, Rod, you know, tomorrow's another day and it can't be as bad as all that. It's an exaggerated response. I throw myself upon the thorns of life. I bleed, you know, from Shelley. An exaggerated response, and it's embarrassing when you make one. And so in the 20th century, I think we fear making exaggerated response so much, we fear sentimentality so much, that we end up almost automatically being ironic, getting distance on everything. Not everyone, but there is a movement. You fear being sentimental, being called sentimental. In poetry, that's a fear. I don't know, Rich, is that in art? I mean, is that a, you know, devil term in art? If somebody says you're sentimental, do they use that term at all as a real negative, or at least a lot of people? Oh, okay.
Avoid it at all costs.
Yeah, and when, it's interesting, I think that's one of the most important risks to run that there is, you know, and to risk it, I don't know if this is right, I don't know my art that much, but in Guernica, Picasso really risked it, didn't he? Especially if you take off the side panels.
Yeah, in art we talk about two kinds, narrative and mood. Mm-hmm. Sentiment. Mm-hmm. So that you have one which is referring to specific incidents that you hook up to. Mood is one that's much more general, that you can feel a part of whether you experienced it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Picasso really jumps right into mood sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly,
mm-hmm.
Even if he's doing a narrative piece.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, like, one definition now, just to what he said, one definition in writing is that sentimental poem is one in which there's only one emotional response to it. A single emotional response to the poem. You know. You read the McEwen poem and you say, you know, you're just lonely, or you just pity, or something like that. And I think that that's why I mentioned the two side panels of Guernica really do something else to the, you know, with the central panel, right? I mean, there's a picture in the middle and then you've got the bull. Wait a minute. There's a different thing happening there. There's another statement being made besides the central, and then there's the other side. And I don't know the right side on the slide that well, but
bull's on the left.
Bull's on the left,
the
and
figure coming through the window.
Comes up,
yeah.
On
the right, yeah.
But the action between that in that whole statement then becomes something that you know, you have the central panel makes you feel one way, and the bull and the and the person coming through the window another, and so it isn't, you never say, I don't think that that's, at least in literary terms, say that's sentimental. But maybe the middle panel would be, at least guys would be throwing mud balls at it. Maybe the middle panel.
Isn't some of the problem with sentiment is that it sort of, I think an artist oftentimes gets in the way of trying to understand where the piece is at, that it really more affirms where you are at, and then so you can so often bring to it your own, well, like the things you were talking about at the very beginning of the class. There's some things that you want, you know, you say, you don't just bring who you are, and or whatever you want to be, and flop around while you're looking or listening,
mm-hmm.
And that sentiment is a thing that you've got.
Mm-hmm.
Sentiment isn't a thing that other people have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't, you know, or at least that's where you begin. You begin with your own, and so if the work really is primarily sentimental, it can often be a way of preventing you from finding out where the poem or the painting really is.
It's hard for me to follow that because we split sentiment and sentimentality in talking about those in literature.
Yeah.
You really,
yeah.
You've got a huge split, and the sentiment is what you're hoping for, and you're risking sentimentality. You know, that's one of the sides of poetry.
Yeah.
Risk sentimentality, shooting for sentiment. The other side is risking nonsense, a kind of a just sort of a yeah. Well, it's not. It's the other. It's the risks there being no emotional response, because it's just crazy stuff, you know, crazy stuff on the page, And the obscurity is on that one side, and on the side, the risk of sentimentality is somebody who's you know, trying to be as clear as possible.
A singular.
Sort of a use of language, too, is involved, as well as subjects and certain perspectives. Yeah?
A couple of things that strike me with that single emotional response, one reminded me of a Bible study on Sunday, how I think living under the fall is living with ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
And for the only place that you can not have to make those kinds of, you know, this is it, that narrow vision of supervision. And then the other thing is that the idea of image, which came to the Charles Williams discussion yesterday, where you bring something with you which will recognize why that image or symbol is meaningful, and yet that has a life of its own too. And I think that there's something in there, it's like the sentiment meets the bridge, or the experience, or your own participation in your life will allow you to see how life participates in that image in a way that you can connect to it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the recognition that you are not that peanut butter bone cage and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then, there's more than that would not hold much, that kind of a statement about loneliness. We have to do a much more ambiguous statement or have a more definite image which has a life of its own that can continue to shed light on lots of other things too.
Mm-hmm. I think one way of saying that, to re-saying that in terms of the lifestyle people have from the abolition of man, it's a sentiment. Well, take it from Bettelheim too. I think it's Bettelheim. Informed heart. That the emotion is informed by the reason, and that sentiment. You know, the informed heart, and the sentimental, using that as a pejorative term, negative, is when it's a uninformed heart, in the sense that the emotion has no sentimental poem is there's a flood going on of a single emotion, and it's washed everything. It's washed perspective out. This ambiguity business is that you do respond to the people you love and with ambiguity, ambiguous feelings too. At certain moments, you're flooded by different emotions, but making a statement about your whole emotional life will yield a great deal of ambiguity. A number of emotional responses will be involved. In here, you get the sentimental. If this poem was all, I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, if the whole poem sounded like that, it'd be a sentimental poem. What's the next line? I have seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter. What? Wait a minute. Now what happens in those two lines? You know, boom, boom. I've wept, though I've wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I've seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter. I am no prophet, and that's no great matter. This little platter, matter, double rhyme, limerick rhyme, bing, bing. What? What's the tone of Prufrock toward himself? Is it the sentimental? Is he ironic? What is it? Yeah, Steve.
I'm confused. You talk about sentiment and sentimentality.
Mm-hmm.
One
mm-hmm.
being where the emotion takes the priority, and the other being where the intellect informs the emotion.
And then the emotion, and back and forth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The man with sentiments is one who there's got a two-way street there between his emotions and his brain.
Well, in reading Prufrock, I don't know, I seem to have got to a point where there's a third option where it goes beyond sentiment and becomes a totally intellectual thing, and when the intellect can't comprehend, to send the messages and the information so you can have any kind of emotional response at all. And so the response is confusion.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I wasn't saying that there are only two responses. What you said is definitely possible. That you have a, you know, you can fear exaggerated response so much that you quit responding. That's the person who's distanced either deadens himself to responding, or will go in nothing buttery. I mean, oh, that's nothing but, and will not allow himself to respond to anything. You know, to fear, when you respond, you risk making an ass out of yourself. And you can fear that so much that you just quit responding actively at all, and get distance, ironic distance on the whole world. And then you really are just holding it off. Everything is distance. And that's something I think, let me just read this thing out. This is a notes on something I'd like to develop, and I haven't developed it. But I grab what you can, and then we're going to do another look at these other poems. Irony shows an awareness of the limits of response, a refusal to make exaggerations. Actually, this can end up with an understatement of response. The refusal to make exaggerations can end up with the understatement of response, and that's much of the of irony is in understatement. This can be an automatic escape from a sentimentality, and if it is so, it is mannered. Sentimentality is an exaggerated response. There is nothing the 20th century fears more than exaggerated response. No one wants to risk being sentimental by a gut response. Now, this has changed, but still many people in much of their life do exhibit this. There is nothing the 20th century fears more than exaggerated response. No one wants to risk being sentimental by a gut response. We tend to seek a hollow maturity and say, oh, that's just, or that's merely. Especially, this is particularly true in colleges and so forth, at least I've experienced that. This fear to respond leads us to irony, a cold irony, and not any warm self-irony that one can have, but a real cold, can lead to a real cold irony. Irony is the tone of the 20th century. It creates a distance between people and a distance between an individual and his environment. It tends to become the 20th century's response or rehash of Victorian moral prudery. And what I mean by that is that you've got a kind of ufta. What do I mean by that? You've got a You have a different kind of prudery. The moral prudery of the Victorian, you know, the common understanding of Victorians is they're moral prudes, real prudes. Now it's an intellectual prudery, kind of, an intellectual sort of thing, that we know better. Of course this. After all, we end up saying, like Pilate, what's truth? This distancing irony is a result and cause of the intellectual over-scrupulousness. If this continues too long, a rebellion is likely to take place, and I think it already has in many of the rebirth of exaggerated religious experience. Many people are involved in throwing themselves into different things, just really throwing themselves in single directions. And I think this can be a result of just being tired of the fearing response. There's a funny thing I might want to add, playing with words a bit. A final irony is that an automatic ironic response to the world is a sentimental response. An automatic ironic response to the world would, by definition, be a sentimental response. And that's funny how it comes around full circle. And especially in grad school, I experienced a lot of this, where people were so, you know, oh, that's sentimental, but they would respond with a single response all the time. everything that they saw and everything that they wrote was always the same single emotional response. That was their response to life. And I says, you're sentimental. You're far more sentimental than I am. You know, far more sentimental than I am.
I don't understand.
Don't worry about it. This is really rough here. I just saw this, and it isn't developed.
Could you again say something about the difference between sentimental and sentimentality?
Well, I'd put them both together. The sentimental and the sentimentality, I would put them together as terms, and I'd put sentiment somewhere else.
Sentiment?
Sentiment, yeah.
And what would be the difference?
No, sentiment is where your emotion is informed by your intelligence. That's from Abolition of Man, the sentiment. The man with the chest has got sentiments, you know. He's got a great deal of blood, but he's not ruled by the dark gods of his blood, you know, that kind of thing. His head has something to do with the his emotion, expression of emotion. And then you cut your sort of the sentimental response, even if it would be violent or something like this, and not with violins, but say timpanis would be, and you really cut your head off, and you just kind of, you're gushing one way or another.
It seems to me, John, that's really crippling in the sense that the main response to me that you would lose would be your one of joy and happiness.
I think, you know, if you're irony really does in the distancing. I mean, you keep things so far away you can't embrace anything. If you're always ironic, you know. If you're overly ironic. And in the sentimentality, you're in a kind of a different world. I think this might be something you were saying, Richie. You're kind of in this thing of your own. Just if you really what you're feeling is not bear that much resemblance to a an impersonally valid reality. You kind of get socked into a purely personal reality with only personal validity that doesn't have any impersonal validity. And you do, yeah. I think you'd be without joy, yeah. There, in either end.
Listen.
I, well, I don't know. I don't know if I couldn't, you know. Don't take my word for it, but I'd think cynic is irony squared. I mean, where if a person keeps, if a person insists on being ironic all the time, or feels that that's a good way to be, you know, he'll eventually end up a cynic, I think. You'll see through everything, in other words. You just keep seeing through everything. That's, again, an abolition of man. You keep seeing through everything. And the point of being able to see through something is in order to see something. And if you just keep seeing through, seeing through, seeing through, pretty soon you're going to say there's nothing to see. And you get cynical. Yeah. Ouch. Okay, what you've said sounds right, but I've got all these terms in my head, and I'm sitting here and I say, wait a minute, I want to think this through, but I don't feel like I can juggle them now, because they're really you know, I think this is really important, and that's why I wanted you to back off of this a little bit, because this is very important, and involve all sorts of things are involved here, and this is just, you know, sort of like a marginal note or a preliminary. I mean, this discussion, but the cynicism, how you can end up, you go through sentimentality, sentiment to sentimentality, and you can really end up a cynic. Now, I don't know exactly how you would go, you know, what trail you would follow to end up there, but I think you could really do that. And the ironic personality that could, you know, end up a cynic too, of a different sort. And I really don't feel like I've got the words. I don't understand that yet, but I got it. It smells, you know, there's a rabbit out there somewhere, or there are flies, you know, flies, Daniel, flies. They're out there, but I don't feel like I can really pursue them now. I guess the question it would be, you know, is Prufrock, in a sense, both sentimental and exceedingly ironic? I mean, is he somehow both of these things? And is, you know, can we move toward answering that kind of a question at all? Why don't you look for a second at Dover Beach? And can I have a copy of these, too? Is there one here?
Yeah.
Thank you. Now, what we're doing today is to look at some other poems before we look at Prufrock. Kind of provide some measure, get some rulers, get some measures, something to put Prufrock up against as a poem, and put it up there and to see what happens to it, so that we can get some perspective on it. And this Dover Beach poem, Matthew Arnold, it was written in the middle 1800s, after the decay of Romanticism, after biblical criticism knocked the bottom out of many people's faith, after Darwin's Origin of the Species was taken to seriously challenge the Bible, challenge faith. Sea is calm tonight. The tide is full, the moon lies fair upon the straits and the French coast. The light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window. He's asking someone, his love, to come to the window. Come to the window, sweet is the night air, only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land. Listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand. Begin and cease, and then again begin, with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Listening to the sea. And it induces a notice, and it sings to him sadness, brings to him sadness. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea, the sea of faith. And all of a sudden, your meaning sort of jumps. The sea of faith was once, too, at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled, but now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar. Faith's long, melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind and down the vast edges, drear and naked shingles of the world. Beaches, stones in the beaches. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love nor light nor certitude nor peace nor help for pain. And how how does that look? How does that help you any in your thinking about Proof Rock? The world is proven to treat Arnold roughly. Reality is not what he expected. The world has not given his expected response. In a sense, he's lost. The world offers what was, what is beautiful and new, is really has no joy for us. No love, no light, no certitude. There's nothing we can be certain of. No peace, no help for pain. And could Proof Rock have said that? Now, Proof Rock was written 50 years later after Dover Beach, and things in terms of faith, things had not gotten that much better. The poem Proof Rock is a pilgrimage towards some overwhelming question. Early in the poem, Proof Rock says, "Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit." What is the question? Talk to you about this darkling plain, talk to you about the Tournier quote, which is on the other worksheet, the worksheet that I gave you. Put that together, too, with this Matthew Arnold. One other statement that Arnold makes, one other statement that Arnold makes about the situation that is that I think parallels some of Proof Rock's situation. Scholar Gypsy, the next poem right at the bottom, he's talking about a guy who is not affected by the modern age, and that's the thou. But thou possessest an immortal lot, and we imagine thee exempt from age and living as thou livest on Gandil's page, because thou hadst what we, alas, have not. For early didst thou leave the world with powers fresh, undiverted to the world without, firm to their mark, not spent on other things, free from the sick fatigue, the languid doubt, which much to have tried in much been baffled brings. O life unlike to ours, who fluctuate idly, without term or scope, of whom each strives nor knows for what he strives, and each half life, and each half lives 100 different lives, who wait like thee but not like thee in hope. We are not like you, we are like this. Thou waitest for the spark from heaven, and we half light half believers of our casual creeds, we light half believers of our casual creeds, who never deeply felt nor clearly willed. What is this on Proof Rock? Who never deeply felt nor clearly willed, whose insight never has borne fruit in deeds, whose insight never has borne fruit in deeds, whose vague resolves never have been fulfilled, for whom each year we see breeds new beginnings, disappointments new, who hesitate and falter life away and lose tomorrow the ground won today. Ah, do not we, wanderer, await it too. Yes, we await it, but it still delays. And then we suffer, and amongst us one is seat upon the intellectual throne, and all his store of sad experience. Well, excuse me, I'm reading this. Okay, yes, we await it, but it still delays. And we suffer, and among us one is seat upon the intellectual throne, and all his store of sad experience he lays bare of wretched days, tells us his misery's birth and growth and signs, and how the dying spark of hope was fed, and how the breast was soothed, and how the head and all his hourly varied anodynes, or his pills. Where, and then, did this get...
Before.
Huh?
The page before.
Is it the page before then? Let's see.
It's on the back of that one. On the back of that one. I'm looking at it right now. Okay. Is it?
Yeah, and this is our wisest person is doing this. Our wisest person, he lays bare of wretched days, tells us his misery's birth and growth and signs, the dying spark of hope is fed, and how the breast was soothed, and how the head and all his hourly varied anodynes. This for our wisest. We others pine and wish the long unhappy dream would end, and waive all claim to bliss, and try to bear with close-lipped patience for our only friend, sad patience, too near neighbor to despair. But none has hope like thine,
Thou through the fields and through the woods doth stray, roaming thy countryside, a truant boy nursing thy project in unclouded joy, and every doubt long blown by time away. Because he was born in days when wits were fresh and clear, and life ran gaily as the sparkling Thames before this strange disease of modern life, with its sick hurry, its divided aims, its heads overtaxed, its palsied hearts, was rife. Fly hence, our contact fear, get away from us, we'll defile you. Fly, still fly, plunge deeper to the bowering wood. Aversem? I don't know that word. But what it means is the when Dido, we heard it lived to, was down in Hades, and her husband that rejected her came down, and she rejected him, just averted, just get away like that. As Dido did with gesture stern from her false friends approaching Hades' turn. Wave us away, keep thy solitude, stay away from us, because our but fly our paths, get away from us, our feverish contact fly, for strong the infection of our mental strife, strong the infection of our mental strife, which, though it gives no bliss, yet spoils for rest, and we should win thee from thy own fair life, like us distracted, like us unblessed. Soon, soon thy cheer would die, thy hopes grow timorous and unfixed, thy powers, thy clear aims be cross and shifting made, and then thy glad perennial youth would fade and grow old at last and die like ours. Now, does Prufrock come out of this vision in any way?
Yeah, the last one.
Yeah, and you have lines in there that really rub right up against, I mean, go along with some things that Prufrock is saying. This is written 50 years before. One reason, because there were so many parallels that could be drawn tomorrow, not now, I have this, and for another reason, this was the style of writing at the time Prufrock was written. And then Prufrock comes on the next page, let us go then, you and I, while the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half years, you know, huh? And that's why it took 7 years before people who were used to reading poetry that was written like this could read that, even though there are real similarities in vision. Real similarities in vision. Okay, look at, I won't do the Genesis, but look at Jeremiah. Where's Jeremiah? Now, the love song of J.L. for Prufrock is—he's lamenting some things, isn't he? It's a lamentation. It's a lamentation. Okay. Love song of J.L. for Prufrock is a lamentation, and so to look at that as lamentation, we should listen to it as a lamentation. Now, you've read Prufrock. I read it before. I think that the way I read it was pretty much the right way. Here's Jeremiah. You have seduced me, Yahweh, and I have let myself be seduced. You have overpowered me. You were the stronger. You were the stronger ruler. I am a daily laughingstock, everybody's butt, as I go down the stairs. Each time I speak the word, I have to howl and proclaim violence and ruin. The word of Yahweh has meant for me an insult, derision all day long. I used to say, I will not think about it. I will not speak in his name anymore. And then there seemed to be a fire burning in my heart, imprisoned in my bones. The effort to restrain it wearied me. I could not bear it. I hear so many disparaging me, terror from every side. Denounce him. Let us denounce him. Now all those who used to be my friends watch for my downfall. Perhaps he will be seduced into error, and then we will master him and take our revenge. But Yahweh is at my side, a mighty hero. My opponents will stumble, mastered, confounded by their failure. Everlasting, unforgettable disgrace will be theirs. But you, Yahweh Sabaoth, you who probe with justice, who scrutinize the loins and heart, let me see the vengeance you will take on them. For I have committed my cause to you. Sing to Yahweh, praise to Yahweh. For he has delivered the soul of the needy from the hands of evil men, and then back. A curse on the day I was born. No blessing on the day my mother bore me. The curse on the man who brought my father the news. A son, a boy, has been born to you, making him overjoyed. May this man be like the towns that Yahweh overthrew without mercy. May he hear alarms in the morning, the war cry in broad daylight, since he did not kill me in the womb. My mother would have been my tomb were her womb, while her womb was swollen with me. Why ever did I come out of the womb to live in toil and sorrow and to end my days in shame? And that's lamentation. That's lamentation. And then proof rock. Where is it in the scale of lamentation? It's a love song. Let's look at to his coy mistress. Now this isn't a love song, this is a seduction song. But the it's one that's referred to in Prufrock. Prufrock talks, some of your notes on Prufrock will show certain lines that were pulled from this. One of the big themes, right? And that one, let's see, the one, two, something like the third, yeah, it's the third paragraph or stanza, if you want to call it that, is on time. And that's a parallel that your notes didn't talk about, but here you have this. The line from Prufrock that they refer to this on is the one about rolling up all our strength, you know. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness into one ball. And that's where they referred to it. But this is something else, too. Now, Proof Rocks is called a love song. Proof Rock has some problems. He's a certain kind of guy. Let's take a look at him by looking at this one. To his coy mistress. Had we but whirled enough in time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. Had we whirled enough in time, this coyness, lady, were no crime.
This
coyness,
coy.
Coy, oh boy. Coy. Tease is the word that I'm thinking.
Flirtation.
Yeah. Flirtation, tease, hard to get. Other words?
Game.
Huh?
Game.
Playing games, you mean? Yeah.
Kind of understated, though, too.
Coy.
Cutie, sorry.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know. You know, not saying yes or no, but always maybe, maybe, maybe. Coy. I think. It's a long string of maybes. Yeah. Yeah. That's from Wasteland, too. My nerves are bad tonight. Bad, oh bad. But that's not, that wasn't quite the coy. But anyway, had we but whirled enough in time, this coyness lady, this messing around lady, were no crime. This coyness lady were no crime if we had whirled enough in time. Is that, those two lines relate to Proof Rock at all?
Yeah.
Would Ape Neck Sweeney, you know, would Ape Neck Sweeney, another character of Eliot's, and he's described as a guy who could, he would be shaving it, he would be shaving, and his love could be having an epileptic fit on the bed beside him, and he could finish shaving without cutting himself. That's Ape Neck Sweeney. And would Ape Neck Sweeney say of Proof Rock, you know, had you but whirled enough in time, your coyness lady would be no crime? I mean, would Ape Neck say this to Proof Rock? We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou by the Indian Ganges side should strew be fines, while I the tide of Himber would complain. He's half a world away, and he would moan. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. You know, we would, you know, if we had all the time, you could, you know, I could start 10 years before the flood, and you could refuse till the conversion of the Jews, which is in the last days, as Paul says, that when the Jews come back, then. If we had all the time we needed. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze, 200 to adorn each breast, but 30,000 years to the rest, an age at least to every part, and for the last age should show thee your heart. For lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. No, when I love. If I had all the time in the world, I would not want to take hurry. I would want to take 30,000 years to love you. I would not love at lower rate. But at my back, you know. If this were so, then it would be okay. But at my back, I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near. And yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song. Then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity, and your quaint honor turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. A fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Is there any connection with Prufrock? There. Now, therefore, you know, if this were so, then, but it is not so, therefore, you get your rhetoric here. Now, therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires, now let us sport us while we may, and now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour. Bite the matter off with a smile. Then languish in his slow-chapped power. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness into one ball, and tear our pleasures with rough strife, and tear our pleasures with rough strife through the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our sun stand still, though we cannot stop time, we will make him run. We will make time fly while we're here. This is one...
this is the love song of someone that Andrew Marvel was writing about, and any contrast, comparison. Okay, now here we go. We're going to talk about this poem for 2 days, and the first day we do this, and I would like to do this to get the background stuff, and we'll go with Prufrock tomorrow. But here, what do I do, you know? I mean, come down, we got 2 sessions, and I hit you with 10 more poems that we're going to talk about. Nice guy. But take a look. Gerontian. I that was near your heart was removed therefrom to lose beauty in terror in inquisition. I have lost my passion. Why should I need to keep it, since what is kept must be adulterated? I have lost my sight, smell, hearing, taste, touch. How should I use them for your closer contact? What images do you have in Prufrock? Whispers of immortality, the line about the arm, braceleted and white and bare, but ugh, in the lamplight, down with light brown hair. You know, and you say, what kind of a turkey, you know, looks at a girl's arm and gets turned off by the hair on the arm, you know? Well, what was your first response, if you've been to Europe, what was your first response to see that dark Spanish beauty's dark Spanish hairy legs, you know? You know? We all respond like this way the first time, you know? Right? Why is that? Why does he do it? Grishkin is nice, her Russian eye is underlined for emphasis. Uncorseted, her friendly bust gives promise of pneumatic bliss. The couched Brazilian jaguar compels the scampering marmoset. The monkey, with subtle effluence of cat, Grishkin has a Massenet, I think. The sleek Brazilian jaguar does not in its arboreal gloom distill so rank a feline smell as Grishkin in a drawing room. And even the abstract entities circumambulate her charm, but our lot crawls between dry ribs to keep our metaphysics warm. What kind of a rejection is going on there? Into what? And what kind of vision? And then what about proof rock? The preludes. I won't read them now. Yes, you can keep these. But so I hit you with 10 more poems, you know. But I also hit you with the footnote from Norton's anthology. Mm-hmm. That'll help. That'll make it up to you. Okay. Footnote. Don't forget to read it.
It's T.S. Eliot's footnote, though.
No, it isn't. Nope. A dramatic monologue in which the speaker builds up a mood of social futility and inadequacy through the thoughts and images which haunt his consciousness and by means of the symbolic landscape in which he moves. The title implies an ironic contrast to the bloop, 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 bloop. It's about a 200-word quick explanation of proof rock. I thought I'd throw that in because I was hitting you with these other poems too. I'd kind of balance.
At the bottom, a footnote on the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot refers to the, by T.S. Eliot is not the footnote but the poem.
Wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
What did I say?
I thought at the end when it said footnote on the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot, that when it said by T.S. Eliot, it referred to the footnote, not to the poem.
Oh, okay. That's right. Norton's anthology. Okay, don't forget to read that and see where you agree and disagree. But look at these poems. We'll make connections tomorrow as we read the poem through. Yeah.